Accession number 13459, reel 3.
This is Bill Wixon, reel 2.
Right, we were at the moment of bomb release over Cologne and the aircraft lifting. Could you sort of guide me on your flight home now?
Yes, well, as soon as the bombs had gone, I mean, there's an immense feeling of relief amongst the crew, certainly with me, and I'm sure the rest of the crew. You're glad to get rid of that cargo, which is sitting beneath you, which at any time could be hit by ACAC and woof, that's it. Enormous sense of relief. And immediately the nav would come up with the heading for home, the course to steer, and the speed that he wanted, which was all preset on his flight plan, obviously. And away you'd go. And thinking, let's have a good run home and hope we don't meet any opposition. And ultimately you would coast in over the Yorkshire moors, and only when you were within about 10 miles of base would you break radio silence. Remember that we'd had no radio messages whatsoever from the time of start-up, take-off, outward bound, over the target, complete radio silence. But once you were within about 10 miles, you would give your call sign. Our call sign for Melbourne aircraft was, at my time on the squadron, was Milk Pail. Milk Pail. And my skipper would call Milk Pail, Milk Pail, F for Freddy, 10 miles, position such and such, and they would give him F Freddy, number 2 to land, or number 3 to land, or join the hold and go around at 2,000 feet, and they would feed you in. And then...
Still no lights?
No, this on this Cologne one was a daylight.
Yeah,
yeah, but no lights. And... on one particular night raid, you mentioned about no lights. On one particular night raid, our aircraft were joining the squadron for landing, and all of a sudden we were alerted, all Milk Pail aircraft, scatter, bandits in the area, which meant that enemy night fighters were on the prowl and actually had followed the bomber stream in and were going to the airfields. And as the aircraft were in that vulnerable position of flaps down and wheels down at a very low speed, joining the circuit, coming into land, were actually shooting aircraft down, and one of our squadron was lost on this particular night. And we scattered, we got the wheels and flaps up and went off full throttle, and for the life of me I can't think where we went to, but we went to some other airfield and sat on the ground until it was all clear, we refueled and all clear to go back. But certainly that one crew went down from our squadron.
Now, you do get damaged on the Cologne raid, didn't you?
In my logbook it says hold in the wing with ACAC. We had considerable damage on different raids. And... this is one reason why you had so many fuel tanks in the wing, so that if you had enemy action that damaged a tank, you didn't lose all your fuel in one wing. All tanks were fitted with a self-sealing rubber type compound, but obviously small damage that would seal, but large damage you would lose a lot of the fuel. And each tank had a fuel gauge, and of course you were scanning fuel contents all the time, and if one tank appeared to be dropping when it shouldn't be dropping, when you're not feeding off that tank, if a tank starts to drop its contents, you whip all four engines over onto that tank to get as much fuel out of it as possible, because all tanks were interconnected with cross-feed pipes and cross-feed lines, and you could run any engine off any tank, or any four engines or combinations of engines off any particular tank. So if a tank was losing fuel, you'd get as much out of it while you can, because if you lose too much fuel, you're not going to make base back home.
And then you could isolate it, I suppose.
Well, you wouldn't want to isolate it. You want to get as much fuel out of it as possible.
I mean, you wouldn't want it, the other tanks to drain through it from the
damage. Oh, no, no. There was, they wouldn't drain through it because the tanks weren't connected from one tank to another tank to another tank. Each tank had its pipe and its on-off cock, and then that would feed into a gallery with cross-feed cocks and things like that. So if you lost one tank through damage, you wouldn't lose fuel back through it from other good tanks. But it was constantly scanning the panel and keeping a check of fuel consumed, because we all knew as flight engineers that whatever the power setting of the engines, like 2400 RPM and 2.5 pounds of boost, would give a certain fuel consumption. And that would be about 240 gallons an hour, and for all four engines at that power setting, roughly. If you reduced the power, then the consumption was less. If you increased the power, the consumption was more. So one of my duties as flight engineer was every time the power was increased, I would note the time on my flight engineer's log, note the power setting, look at my little chart and see what the fuel consumption was, and then when the power was reduced, the time factor we'd been at that power setting, I could calculate with my little... we never had calculators, electronic calculators in those days. We had a little brass calculator that you just turn the wheels and it would come up with a figure. Like 240 gallons an hour for so many minutes would show that you'd consume so much fuel. So you'd put that on your log, fuel consumed from the particular tanks you were using. So you knew at any time what fuel you should have in each tank. Because remember that... at any time through enemy action, you could lose the tank contents gauges through electrical problems through enemy action, and so you'd have a load of tanks, 14 tanks, not reading. Well, if you didn't know what was in what, you could be in trouble. So you had to know exactly what was left. And
how often did you monitor fuel state?
All the time, yeah. As a flight engineer, I didn't have a seat on the Halifax. I was stood on the oxygen bottles. The oxygen bottles were beneath me, and then there was a plywood cover. And I stood on those with my head in the Astrodome, which is a Perspex dome, which I could look out and monitor for any enemy aircraft or other vicinity of aircraft, this, that and the other. And my panel was there, and I was constantly scanning the panel. Oil pressures, oil temperatures, hydraulic pressures, brake pressures, pneumatic pressures, fuel contents, all the time.
Where did you go for takeoff and landing? Just brace yourself against the spar or something?
Yeah, stood on my oxygen bottles,
yeah.
Braced against the side of the aircraft, one side and the upright, or a staunchion, or even facing forward initially, and then turning around and monitoring my instruments for the takeoff with my back braced against the panel between me and the skipper, and my feet forward at the bottom of the panel and just braced like that.
Did you have your own set of throttles?
No, not on the Halifax, no. The throttles were just round the corner on the skipper's position.
So you could come and help him?
Maybe. Oh, yes, yeah.
He was having difficulty.
All I had to do was just step off my bottles and into the gangway, and he was immediately in front of me. I mean, I could see everything although there was a bulkhead between me and the skipper, the top part of it was heavy bulletproof glass about 2 inches, 2.5 inches thick. So I could look through there and see everything that was going on.
You carried a co-pilot?
No. The bomb aimer would sit... No, strange you should mention that. I can't recall whether there was a swing-up seat. The bomb aimer used to be beside the skipper for takeoff. I can't recall whether there was a swing-up seat. On another aircraft I flew, the Lincoln, we had a lift-up seat, and the engineer sat on that all the time. I guess we must have had a swing-up seat for the bomb aimer to sit there for takeoff, and then he would drop his seat after takeoff and go forward into his bombing position, and he would help the navigator on navigation.
But there were no, as far as I know, neither the Lancaster nor the Halifax were dual control, were they?
No, we never had dual control. No, well, it was the Lincoln had dual control.
Did it?
Yeah, which was a follow-up version of the Lancaster.
But the, you were very vulnerable. The pilot was very vulnerable because he was badly injured or killed.
He'd have to be pulled out of the seat.
And did
another crew member get in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not necessarily a pilot.
Oh no, definitely not a pilot.
So it's a bit of a dodgy do then if that happened. You know.
Yeah. Well. All aircrew, with the exception of gunners, would have a link trainer. A link trainer is a little model aircraft that you fly, and it never goes anywhere. It dips its nose and stands on its tail and dips its wings. But it has all flying controls, and there is a control table outside with a crab that creeps across the surface of that table, and you can fly exercises and... Whatever you do with the aircraft, the link trainer aircraft, that crab would follow it and map it out. So we would all have flying training in that respect, but we'd not have actual flying experience for real.
So you could probably fly the aircraft home and bail out if necessary when you got over.
Yeah, that would be the idea, yes, because you would never attempt to land it. This, fortunately, never happened to me, but one or two other people have actually taken control of aircraft and brought them back over, crossing the channel, and then bailed out. That must have happened on numerous occasions. On later aircraft I flew, they had dual control, and then one could practice flying the aircraft for real, and... Don't quote me, but lots of flight engineers have taken aircraft off and landed aircraft strictly against rules and regulations, but it's been done.
Because the Lancaster was modified at the end of the war for maritime reconnaissance, and I went on board one of those, and they had a duel.
Yes.
Because of the long duration.
Yeah.
You had automatic pilot, presumably.
Yes, but we rarely used it. We didn't like it.
Was it a towering plane to fly manually, the Halifax?
No, not
very
really.
Light, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Mm.
Now tell me...
I was just speaking to this last couple of weeks at one of our pilots at this Bomber Command reunion, and I heard him say, someone said, did you have George, the automatic pilot? Never used it, he said. The number of times that that has suddenly put the aircraft on its tail or on its nose, he said, wouldn't bother with it, he said. I want the feel of the airplane.
The other thing I want to ask you about is that did you ever have to come home with your bombs? I mean, it was clouds over target, or you had a hang-up or something?
Yes, on a couple of occasions. On one occasion, we were outbound to Essen, and that was the target, and... we lost an engine, oil pressure failure, and we had to shut the engine down. And we just made our way to the designated bomb disposal area in the North Sea.
And that was standard practice.
That was standard practice. There was a set area in the North Sea that crews would make for and jettison their bombs, because that area... presumably would be on all shipping plans and things like that to avoid that area. That was on one occasion when we were outbound. and so we never actually made Essen. And another occasion where we couldn't make a target and we had an alternative target, but for the life of me I couldn't tell you what it was. It's surprising how memory lets you down over all these years.
Did you ever have a hang-up?
Oh yes, yeah, I've had hang-ups, and that was my job, to release the hang-up. And
did you ever have to land with a live bomb?
No, never done that. I've always managed to release them. And through some electrical fault on the bomb release mechanism, when the bomb aimer presses his bomb release tit, that energizes all the little solenoids on the bomb holders, and the solenoid flips back and the weight of the bomb takes the bomb away. But sometimes bad contact or icing or something like that, and the bomb wouldn't go. Of course, he would say, I've got to hang up number so-and-so position. And I would go back with a screwdriver and undo the little zoo fasteners and lift the plate off and look through and say, yeah, you've got to hang up. And I would be told when to release it. And then at a point on the homeward journey, I would be told to release it.
So you had a little local release switch or something?
No, no, I have a little manual trigger on the bomb release mechanism whereby I could release the mechanism there. And I don't know, but I presume that it would be, I would be told to release it when we were over another target, or when we were over the North Sea, or the Channel, or what, I don't know. Just glad to get rid of it, I suppose.
Can I ask you a bit now about the emotional pressures behind this kind of operational flying? Because you mentioned earlier on that you're all dead keen to get going.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, once you'd got on operations and you noticed that some of your mates weren't coming back,
yeah,
and you may have been through one or two pretty dangerous sorties, and there obviously were recorded cases of people who couldn't carry on.
Yeah.
I mean, do you remember being under pressure yourself?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember being frightened?
Oh, yeah. Every trip. Every trip. Well, I'm not ashamed to say so. When you're going over a target, in the daylight, when you're crossing enemy territory in the daylight, all the towns are heavily defended with AK-AK. And you can just see over certain cities and towns, the sky is black with puffs, with balls of black smoke. And you think, God, we're never going to get through that lot. But if you remember what you're told at briefing, all the flak that you can see has been and gone. It's only the brand new balls of black smoke that appear that is the active, isn't it? All the other is just hanging in the air.
It's all raining down on
yeah.
the people keeping sentry.
Yeah,
like you
right, yeah. But all that flak you can see over a target, if it's been thrown up there for an hour, is going to be absolutely black, but it's all been and gone. It's only the new stuff that's going to hurt you. But so you can have that reassuring thought. But at night, on a night raid, the sky is just lit up, and you might not have seen an aircraft for 3 hours. Any of your friends just felt their presence with slipstreams. But when you come to a target area, remember that you're attacking in waves, and you might be coming over the target half an hour after the first wave, the ground is all lit up with incendiary fires, masses and masses of searchlights, and flak exploding all the time, and cannon shells. It's remarkable, like cannon fire or anti-aircraft, equivalent to our Bofors guns, where they go bum, 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 and those shells are all going up, the German equivalent. They come up like tracer, and they seem to come ever so slow, a big white ball, one, two, three, ever so slowly, and then woof, they're gone. As they're coming, you don't appreciate their speed, but then when they're gone, you realise the speed. And the exploding shells, oh, it's enough to frighten anyone fartless. And I can't say that people would be that steely-eyed to not turn a hair. You just hope to God you get through it. Now, you said that people get very scared and couldn't go on operations. That is true. And the term that was used was LMF, lack of moral fibre. And nobody wanted that accusation to be thrown at them, LMF. And I can quite imagine people who were absolutely terrified to go on operations would still go and still do their job because they wouldn't want to be accused of LMF. And also, when you're sitting in a crew being briefed on a particular target, you're not going to show fear in front of the rest of your crew. And they're all sort of braving it off because they don't want to show fear to you. But everyone's innermost thoughts is this going to be the last one? Or am I going to get back all right? And it is incredible that even on the last day of the war, aircraft were going down. I remember one raid towards the very end of the war where we were bombing the Frisian Islands off Holland, and our squadron went in, and with other Halifax squadrons on a daylight run, Wangerooge was the target. And I was up in the Astrodome looking out, and there were two Halifaxes about a quarter of a mile over on my starboard side, and one above got hit by flak, and there were two, more or less one above the other, and the top one got hit by flak, and he just nosedived over, and he went straight down, and I watched him go straight down, and as he went down, he chopped his wing chopped the tail off the other Halifax that was flying beneath him, so that one went over as well, and I don't know what I said, but I said something on the intercom, and there was about four or five shoots came out of that, and that I can still see that chopped off tail doing a falling leaf pattern, ever so much slower than the aircraft that was being powered down by its four engines, just doing a falling leaf like that, and people in the crew, our crew, were saying, "Come on, get out, get out, get out," and eventually that gunner got out of his turret. And that was in the last couple of weeks of the war. And it's incredible when I hear people say, "Oh, you did your tour of operations in 1944 and 45. I did mine in 41 and 42. It was more, there were more losses in those days, you know, it was harder. Doesn't matter how hard it was by the year, if you're being shot down, it's hard, isn't it? Even if it's in the last day of the war. And that is a bit, upsets me sometimes, and it upsets other people. Likewise, one could say, at the end of the war, I filled in forms to get my medals, and I was awarded the France and Germany Star for bomber operations. Because my operations were commenced after June the 6th, 1944, because they were commenced after D-Day, I received the France and Germany Star for bombing operations. Friends of mine who did their operations before D-Day received the Aircrew Europe Star. Now, there was a differential. Somebody who assessed what medals were going to be given out decided that operations up to D-Day merited the Aircrew Europe Star. Operations after D-Day merited the France and Germany Star. From the collector's point of view, in modern day, France and Germany Star is worth about £10. But the Aircrew Europe Star is worth about £90 to £100. It's a more sought-after medal. But the aircrew who flew before D-Day and after D-Day, although they went through the same traumatic experiences, didn't receive the same award on the medal. And I find that, on behalf of the bureaucrats who sought all this out, I think it was most grossly unfair. Grossly unfair. Much the same way as I've said a little while ago about modern-day medals, decorations. The present government have done away with the fact that somebody gets the Distinguished Flying Cross because he's an officer, and he gets the DFM, Distinguished Flying Medal, because he's an NCO. Now they're going to do away with that differentiation. Each will get the same, which is true.
Can I just go back to the war, you know, on the subject of stress and so on? Because I've read a lot that you tended to have really the best parties going because you didn't know if you're going to be around the next night.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, did you tend to have a very foreshortened view of your future?
I certainly did.
You didn't plan anything?
No. I hadn't got much money to plan anything anyway. If I had £3 in my pocket, I was very rich. And on our stand-down nights, we would invariably go into York. And York, in those days, was an absolute... During daylight hours, looking across the market square of York and the main streets and Coney Street and the High Street, was a sea of blue uniforms from all the Air Force bases in the Vale of York, would all make for York. And we used to get into the pubs and, we used to booze away, try and get as many pints down you as possible. Seems a bit daft now, but we used to aim to drink as many half pints in as many pubs as possible. It was a task that we wanted to achieve. A half pint in this pub, a half pint in the King's Arms down on the River Ouse in York, up the steps into the Greyhound, a half a pint there, and then across to the other one, a half a pint. We'd only get to about four pubs, because we'd order halves, seven halves for the crew, and up would come seven pints. And the landlord would say, well, we only want halves. 7 pints, lads, no payment. A little old boy in the corner has just bought you those. And there'd be a little old Yorkshire man in the corner with his bowler hat and his walking stick. And he'd say, well done, lads, have those on me. And we'd meet this hospitality in the pubs all over York. And then we always used to try to get to the De Grey rooms in York, near Bootham Gate, the De Grey rooms, which is now the tourist publicity, tourist information office. But the De Grey rooms was a dance floor, and you had to be in the De Grey rooms by 10 o'clock, otherwise they wouldn't let you in because you'd be too full up with ale. So we would get into the De Grey rooms, fairly full up with ale, looking for a young lady to have the last dance with and walk home. Life had no expectancy, really, and you just whooped it up while you had the money. When you hadn't got the money, you borrowed off someone who had. And if you hadn't got the money, you went to the camp cinema and watched cinemas or an ENSA show. ENSA stands for Every Night Something Awful, I'm told.